Chapter 39. Nantucket Shoals. The mini-submersible was barely a few fathoms below Nantucket Sound's blue-green waters, and Austin was already having second thoughts about diving with Zavala. His misgivings had nothing to do with Zavala's skill as a pilot. There was hardly a craft in, on, or above the water Joe couldn't operate. It was his off-key singing. As the crane lifted the two passenger craft off the deck and into the water, Zavala had broken into a Spanish rendition of Yellow Submarine. Austin barked into his microphone. "Do you know any other songs?" "I'm taking audience requests." "How about singing Far, Far Away?" Zavala's quiet laughter came over the earphones. "Gee, I haven't heard that one since I was a muchacho." "Desperate times call for desperate measures." "No problema. It sounds better with a guitar anyway. Where do you want to go, amigo?" "How about down, for starters?" Zavala's wave of acknowledgement was visible through the observation bubble that was so close Austin could have reached out and touched his colleague on the shoulder, if not for the plexiglass that enclosed their heads. The twin domes were mounted at the front of the mini-sub, jutting at an angle from its flat green ceramic surface like the bulbous eyes of a frog. The Deep Flight II was unlike most deep-ocean submersibles and bathyscaphs, which tended to be shaped like a fat man, rotund and thick around the waist. It looked more like a futuristic fighter plane than an undersea vehicle. The fuselage was rectangular and flat, with the leading and trailing edges tapering like the business end of a chisel. The sides were perpendicular to the flat top and bottom, with sharp edges as if canvas had been stretched over a frame. The wings were stubby and squared off and equipped with fixed running lights. Thruster fans were mounted behind the wings and observation domes. At the front were a pair of manipulator arms and a movable spotlight. Unlike the crew of a traditional submersible, who sat upright as if at a desk, Austin and Zavala lay prone, sphinx-like, face forward, strapped into form-fitting pans, elbows set into padded receptacles. They had dual controls, including a joystick for elevation and another for speed. Zavala handled the sub, while Austin took care of the other systems, such as lights, video, and the manipulator arms. He kept an eye on the heads-up digital display that contained compass, speedometer, and odometer, and controls for depth gauge, air conditioning, strobe unit, and sonar. The craft was slightly buoyant and dove by moving through the water and adjusting the elevators in its tail section like an airplane. Their bodies were elevated at a 30-degree angle to simulate the natural position of a person swimming. This attitude also made rapid descents and ascents less frightening. The space was adequate for Austin's 6'1" height, but snug around his broad shoulders. Still, he had to admit, even with Zavala's serenade, it was a pleasant way to scout out a wrecked ocean liner. The wreck was marked by a red spherical buoy. Zavala put the sub into a slow series of descending circles around the buoy line, which ran down 180 feet from the surface to a length of chain attached to the third portside lifeboat davit. Normal descent to the highest part of the wreck took 3 to 4 minutes. With its 5-knot speed, the mini-sub could make the trip in a fraction of that time. But Austin wanted to get a feel for the environment they would be working in. He asked Zavala to ease them to the bottom. The deepening water filtered the colors out of the sunlight streaming down from the surface. The red tints disappeared first, then on through the spectrum. At 5 fathoms, all hues had been lost except for a cold, bluish green. In compensation for the artificial dusk, the water became as clear as fine crystal as the sub broke through the warmer layers of thermocline where particles of vegetation were held in suspension. The sub corkscrewed lazily into the sea around the anchor line. A huge dark mass loomed from the pale bottom sand and filled their vision. With the excellent visibility, the sub had been running without lights. At a depth of 120 feet, Zavala flattened their trajectory, slowed the mini-sub's speed to a crawl, and switched on the craft's belly light. The ship lay on its side. The large circle of illumination transformed a section of the hull below them from black to a cadaverish grayish-green, broken here and there with leprous splotches of yellow and rust stains like dried blood. The patina of marine growth, made up of millions of sea anemones, stretched off into the dimness beyond the reach of the light. Austin found it difficult to imagine that this huge dead leviathan was once one of the fastest and most beautiful ships afloat. It is possible to stand before a building as tall as the Doria was long and not be awed by its size. But if that same 700-foot tower is turned horizontally and placed by itself on a flat, empty plain, its immensity becomes breathtaking. Lying on its starboard or right side, hiding the fatal gash from the Stockholm's sharp beak, the Doria looked like a monstrous sea creature that had simply lain down to rest, had fallen asleep, and was now being reclaimed by the sea. The mini-sub switched on its video camera and glided toward the stern, staying a short distance above the rows of portholes. Dwarfed by the massive hull, the craft resembled a little bug-eyed crustacean checking out a whale. Near the 16-ton portside propeller, Zavala made a sharp turn and passed over the sharply etched black rectangles that once served as windows to the promenade deck. When open water appeared, he dropped the sub down to a depth of 200 feet and pointed the craft back toward the bow on a path parallel to their earlier course. The multi-tiered decks were a 90-foot-high vertical wall off to their left. They moved past the three swimming pools that had once cooled passengers according to class on their transatlantic passage, scudding along the lifeboat deck, whose davits didn't work any better now than they did in 1956. Dozens of fishing nets had become snagged on the hook-like davits. The nets veiled the decks like great shrouds draped over an immense bier. The mesh was coated with a hoary cloak of marine growth. Some nets, held aloft from the wreck by their buoys, were still snaring fish from the schools of large pollock and cod that darted dangerously close. Noting the rotting bones caught in the mesh, Zavala wisely kept the mini-sub at a respectful distance from the still dangerous nets. The ship's great red-and-white smokestack had fallen off, leaving an immense square shaft down to the engine room. Other openings marked uncovered staircase wells. The superstructure had slipped off and lay in a jumble of disintegrating debris on the sea bottom. With its distinctive stack and superstructure gone, the Andrea Doria looked more like a barge than a ship. Only when they glided by the remnants of the wheelhouse and saw the massive booms, winch heads, and bollards intact on the foredeck did they begin to get the sense that this was a huge passenger liner. It was hard to believe a vessel this big could ever sink, but that's what they said about the Titanic, Austin reminded himself. They had been as reverent as mourners at a funeral, but now Austin broke the silence. That's what $30 million looks like after a few decades at the bottom of the sea. Head of a lot of money to pay for an oversized fish catcher, Zavala said. That's just for the hull. I didn't count the millions in furnishings and artwork and 400 tons of freight. The pride of the Italian Navy. I can't figure it, Zavala said. I know all about the thick fog, but both these ships had radar and lookouts. How in all of those millions of square miles of ocean did they happen to occupy the same space at the same time? Plain lucky, I guess. They couldn't have done better if they planned out a collision course in advance. 52 people dead. A 29,000-ton ocean liner on the bottom. The Stockholm heavily damaged. Millions in cargo lost. That's some planning. I think you're telling me it's one of those unsolved mysteries of the sea. Do you have a better answer? Not one that makes any sense, he replied with a sigh that was audible over the mic. Where to now? Let's go up to Gimbel's Hole for a look-see, Austin said. The mini-sub banked around as gracefully as a manta ray and headed back toward the bow, then cruised evenly about halfway down the length of the port side until it came to a jagged, four-sided opening. Gimbel's Hole. The 8-by-20-foot hole was the legacy of Peter Gimble. Less than 28 hours after the Doria went under, Gimble and another photographer named Joseph Fox dove on the liner and spent 13 minutes exploring the wreck. It was the start of Gimble's fascination with the ship. In 1981, he led an expedition that used a diving bell and saturation diving techniques. The divers cut away the entrance doors into the first-class foyer lounge to get at a safe reported to hold $1 million in valuables. Amid great hoopla, the safe was opened on TV, but it yielded only a few $100s.
"Looks like a barn door," Zavala quipped.
"This barn door took 2 weeks to open with magnesium rods," Austin said. "We don't have that long."
"Might be easier to raise the whole thing."
If Numa could raise the Titanic, the Doria should be a cinch."
"You're not the first one to suggest that. There have been a pile of schemes to bring her up. Compressed air, helium-filled balloons, a cofferdam, plastic bubbles, even ping-pong balls."
"The ping-pong guy must have had some cojones," Zavala whistled.
Austin groaned at the Spanish double entendre.
"Aside from that astute observation, from what you've seen, what do you think?"
"I think we've got our work cut out for us."
"I agree. Let's go topside and see what the others say."
Zavala gave him a thumbs up, tweaked the motor, and lifted the nose of the sub. As they quickly ascended with the power from 4 thrusters, Austin glanced at the gray ghost receding in the gloom. Somewhere in that huge hull was the key to the bizarre series of murders. He put his grim thoughts aside as Zavala broke into a Spanish chorus of Octopus's Garden. Austin thanked his lucky stars that the trip was short. The deep flight broke the surface in an explosion of froth and foam. Through the water-streaked observation bubbles, a gray-hulled boat with a white superstructure was visible about 150 feet away. The mini-sub was as agile as a minnow underwater. On the surface, its flat planes were susceptible to the wave motion, and it rocked in the slight chop, being kicked up by a freshening breeze. Austin didn't normally get seasick, but he was starting to feel green around the gills and was happy when the boat got underway and rapidly covered the distance between them. The boat's design was typical of many salvage and survey ships, whose main function is to serve as a platform for lowering, towing, and hauling various instruments and vehicles. It had a snub tugboat's bow and a high forecastle, but most of the 65-foot length was open deck. At either side of the deck was an elbow crane. An A-frame spanned most of the 22-foot beam at the stern where a ramp slanted down to the sea. 2 men in wetsuits pushed an inflatable down the ramp into the water, jumped into it, and skimmed over the wavetops to the mini-sub. While 1 man manned the tiller, the other secured the sturdy hook to a grommet at the front of the submersible. The line led to a deck winch that pulled the mini-sub closer, the boat maneuvering until the deep flight was on its starboard. A crane swung over and lowered tackle that was attached by the men in the inflatable to cleats on the sub. The cable went taut. The sub and its passengers were lifted dripping from the sea, swung over the deck, and lowered onto a steel cradle. The operation was handled with Swiss watch precision and dispatch. Austin would have expected nothing less than perfection from one of his father's boats. After the revealing session at the Peabody, Austin had called Rudy Gunn to fill him in and request a salvage vessel. Numa had dozens of ships involved in its far-flung operations. That was the problem, Gunn explained. The agency's boats were flung all around the globe. Most carried scientists who had stood in line for a spot on board. The nearest ship was the Nereus, still in Mexico. Austin said he didn't need a full-blown salvage ship, but Gunn said the quickest he could get something to Austin was a week. Austin told him to make a reservation and hung up. After a moment's thought, he dialed again. The voice, like a bear coughing in the woods, came on the line. Austin told his father what he needed.
"Ha!" the older man guffawed. "Christ sakes, I thought Numa had more ships than the U.S. Navy. Can't the Admiral spare you one dinky boat from his fleet?"
Austin let his father enjoy his gloat.
"Not in the time I need it. I could really use your help, Pop."
"Help comes with a price tag, lad," the old man said slyly.
"Numa will reimburse you for any expenses, Pop."
"I could give a rat's ass about money,"
he growled. "My accountant will find a way to put it down as a charitable donation if he doesn't get sent to Alcatraz before then. If I get you something that floats, does that mean you'll wrap up whatever nonsense Sandecker's got you involved in and get you out here to see me before I'm so damned senile I don't recognize you?"
"Can't promise anything. There's a good chance of it."
"Huh. Finding a boat for you isn't like hailing a cab, you know. I'll see what I can do." He hung up. Austin laughed softly. His father knew exactly where every vessel he owned was and what it was doing, down to the smallest rowboat. Dad wanted to let him wiggle on the hook. Austin wasn't surprised when the phone rang a few minutes later. The gruff voice said, "You're in luck. Got you an old scow. We've got a salvage vessel doing some work for the Navy off Sandy Hook, New Jersey. Not one of your big research vessels, but she'll do fine. She'll put into Nantucket Harbor tomorrow and wait for you."
"Thanks, Pop. I really appreciate it."
"I had to twist the captain's arm, and I'll lose money on this job," he said, his tone softening. "But I guess it's worth it to get my son out here in my declining years."
What an actor, Austin thought. His father could whop his weight in Wildcats. True to his word, the senior Austin had the boat in Nantucket the next day. The Monkfish was hardly a scow. It was, in fact, a medium-sized, state-of-the-art salvage vessel less than 2 years old. An added bonus was Captain John McGinty, a hard-boned, ruddy-faced Irishman from South Boston. The captain had dived on the Andrea Doria years before and was delighted to work on her again. Austin was removing the cassette from the mini-sub's video camera when McGinty strode over.
"Well, don't keep me in suspense," he said with excitement in his voice. "How's the old gal look?"
"She's showing her age, but you can see for yourself."
Austin handed over the cassette. The captain glanced at the mini-sub and chuckled.
"That's some hot rod," he said, and led the way to his quarters.
He set Austin and Zavala up with soft chairs and hard drinks, then popped the video into his VCR. McGinty sat in uncharacteristic silence, taking in every detail as the swept-back hull and its patina of anemones rolled across the TV screen. When the video ended, he punched the rewind button.
"You boys did good work. She looks pretty much the way she did when I last dove on her in 87. Except there are more trawler nets. And like you said," he sighed, "she's getting a little worn around the edges. It's what you can't see that's the problem. I've heard the ship's interior bulkheads are rotting away. Won't be long before the whole thing collapses in on itself."
"Could you give us an idea what we'll be dealing with down there?"
"I'll do my best. Want a refill?"
Not waiting for an answer, he poured the equivalent of a double shot of Jack Daniels into each glass and dropped in a couple of token ice cubes. He took a sip, staring at the blank TV screen.
"One thing you can't forget. The Doria may look pretty, even with all that scum mucking up her hull, but she's a man-killer. They don't call her the Mount Everest of divers for nothing. She hasn't killed as many as Everest. Around 10 last time I got counting, but the guys who dive on the Doria are looking for that same adrenaline rush from the danger that mountain climbers get."
"Every wreck has its own character," Austin said. "What are the major hazards on this ship?"
"Well, she's got all sorts of tricks up her sleeve. First of all, there's the depth, with a 2-hour decompression. You need a dry suit because of the cold. Sharks come to feed on the fish, mostly blues. Not supposed to be dangerous, but when you're hanging on the anchor line decompressing, you just hope some nearsighted shark doesn't mistake you for a fat pollock.
When I first started diving, my father told me to remember that in the water you are no longer at the top of the food chain," Austin said.
McGinty grunted in agreement.
"None of that stuff would be major except for the other problems. There's always a wicked current. It can be bad all the way down and even runs through the boat. Sometimes it seems like it will pull you right off the anchor line."
"I felt it pushing against the mini-sub," Zavala said. McGinty nodded.
"You saw what the visibility was like."
"We could see pretty well today. We found the wreck without our lights," Austin said.
"You were lucky. Sun was shining. Sea wasn't stirred up much. On a cloudy or foggy day, you can be practically on the wreck without seeing it. That's nothing compared to inside. Black as Hades, silt all over the place.
Just touch it, and you're surrounded by a cloud so thick your light won't penetrate it. Real easy to get confused and lost. But the biggest problem is entanglement. You can get into real trouble with all the wires and cables hanging down from the ceilings. That's if you get past those nets and ropes all over the hull and the monofilament from the party boats that fish the wreck. It's invisible. You don't know it's there until it's grabbed onto your tank. With scuba, you've got 20 minutes max to get yourself out of trouble.
That's not much time to explore a huge ship.
That's one of the reasons it's so damn dangerous. Fellows want that piece of pottery or dish with the Italia crest on it. Figure they've spent all that time training and money to get out there. They forget. They get tired real fast, especially if they're fighting the current and breathing trimix. Make mistakes. Get lost. Forget the plans they memorized. Equipment's got to be working perfectly. One guy died because he had the wrong mix in his tanks. On my last dive, I had 5 tanks, weight belt, lights, knives. I was carrying 228 pounds. It takes a lifetime of experience to dive the ship. Even so, it's easy to become disoriented. You've got the ship lying on its side, so the deck and floors are overhead. The bulkheads between the decks are vertical.
The Andrea Doria sounds like just our kind of place, doesn't it, Joe?
Only if the bar still serves tequila.
McGinty furrowed his brow.
Ordinarily, this kind of cockiness before a Doria dive was a one-way ticket to a body bag. He wasn't sure about these two. The big man with the hair that didn't match the unlined face and the soft-spoken dark man with the bedroom eyes exuded an unusual confidence. The captain's worried expression disappeared, and he grinned like an old hound dog. No, it wouldn't surprise him to see them belly up to the Doria's first-class bar and order a drink from a ghostly bartender.
Austin said, "What's the weather going to be like, Captain?"
"Weather tends to be cantankerous as hell out here on the shoals. Calm one day, howling gale the next. Fog is notorious. The guys who were aboard the Doria and the Stockholm could tell you how thick it gets. Wind's blowing southeast now, but it will come around more westerly, and my guess is you'll have flat seas. Don't know how many days that will last out here."
"That's okay. We're in something of a hurry to get the job done," Austin said. "We don't have days."
McGinty grinned.
"Yep. Damned cocky."
"We'll see. Still, I've got to admit you boys have got brass. What's this you're looking for, an armored truck in the hold? That's going to require some doing, especially where you don't know the wreck."
He shook his head.
"Wish I could help you, but my diving days are over. You could use a guide."
Austin saw a blue hull come into view through a porthole. The name Myra was painted on the bow. "Excuse me, Captain," he said. "I think our guide has just arrived."